Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. We'll be joined in a moment by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who is the Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell in the Department of State from August 2002 to January of 2005. He's the first to go public with criticism of the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. And in today's Washington Post, Sunday's Washington Post, the first of a four-part series called Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. Angler, of course, is the Secret Service name for Dick Cheney. So we'll be analyzing the role of Dick Cheney in a moment in this administration, the inordinate and unusual and unprecedented influence he has in terms of being vice president. And we'll also be joined later in the program by Robert Baer, who's a CIA case officer from 76 to 1997. He's the character upon which Syriana and the role that George Clooney played and was an Academy Award nominee for in Syriana. He speaks Arabic and Farsi. He'll be joining us later in the program to analyze the situation both in Iraq, the possibility of some military action against Iran, either deliberate or accidental, and also the release this week of the so-called CIA crown jewels of secrets that have been held up for some time. And then we'll also talk to Glenn Greenwald, author and journalist who writes for Salon.com. He's the author of How Would a Patriot Act? His new book is called Tragic Legacy. He'll be joining us. I'm now speaking with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who served as Secretary of State Colin Powell, Chief of Staff at the Department of State from August 2002 to January of 2005. And you, of course, were the first to break ranks or go public after you left the State Department. And after the first Bush term, and coined the phrase the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal. And, of course, in today's Sunday's Washington Post is the first of a four-part series, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. And they've obviously devoted considerable resources to analyzing the unprecedented role of Dick Cheney. They quote here in the article, when he first got the job, which I think he, to some extent, gave himself the job. Dan Quayle meets with him to give him some sort of advice of what a kind of miserable job it is being vice president. You basically travel around and go to funerals. And Cheney says with a little smile, "I have a different understanding with the president." So were you aware when you and Colin Powell began in the administration the nature of the understanding that Dick Cheney had with President Bush?
I can't speak for Secretary Powell. I can certainly speak for myself and say no, and I can surmise that Secretary Powell was not aware of it. I'm not sure that anyone wouldn't have at least thought twice, maybe three times, about accepting a cabinet post, knowing that there was such an agreement, particularly Colin Powell, because we, after all, had served under Mr. Cheney as Secretary of Defense, and at least from his management style, leadership style, and I will say from the coldness of his leadership and management style, the methodical nature of it, we knew him quite well.
So could one say that Secretary of State Powell was sort of had from the beginning, that he thought he had the job, but really the job was cut out from under him?
I'm not sure that I would go that far, but I will say that I don't believe that Secretary Powell knew how much power was going to be vested in the Vice President of the United States. I mean, who could guess that Dick Cheney would be, I think all scholars, all experts, all historians in the future will agree to this, the most powerful Vice President to this point in our history.
And it's not just in the national security field. He has, according to this new article in Sunday's Washington Post, he served as gatekeeper of Supreme Court nominees, a referee to the cabinet turf disputes, arbiter of budget appeals, editor of tax proposals, and also later in the series they'll be talking about his role in environmental policy and dominating budget decisions, as well as, of course, the legacy of torture. Does this mean, or did you, when you were in the government, did you notice in any way that he has this kind of, apparently, a network of people throughout all the government departments?
Within the first year, we began noticing it, and we also began noticing that, unlike the rest of us, who were operating more or less on a crisis du jour agenda, with a vision of freedom and open markets and democracy and so forth, a general vision, were operating against people, largely led by Cheney and augmented mightily by Rumsfeld at the Defense Department, who had a very singular vision and had a strategy for carrying out that vision and were utterly ruthless in executing it. They brooked no opposition, and the vice president was the person to whom they went ultimately if they met any opposition. And generally speaking, unless the president were to weigh in, which he did once or twice on key issues, the vice president got his way.
And the article, again, mentions the Washington Post article titled Angler, which, of course, is the Secret Service handle for Dick Cheney, the Cheney vice presidency. It begins describing a situation where the Military Commissions Act was done with in stealth with great speed, and suddenly Colin Powell sees on CNN that it's a fait accompli, and what the hell just happened? Can you fill us in a little bit on the atmospherics there?
Well, actually, I believe that was, rather than the MCA, which was a recent piece of legislation, sure. I think that was the ultimate February 7, 2002 memorandum that came out from the president that essentially delineated our policy with regard to detainee management in the so-called global war on terror. And I will just say this about the article, and I find this amusing to a certain extent, sad but amusing, that the two authors of the article in the Post this morning say that Cheney doesn't live up to the accusations that he's the real president, and then go on and describe that he made most of the major national security decisions in the administration. And this was one that emanated from his network, you, Flanagan, and most importantly, the Eminos Gris, the man behind the throne in the Cheney shop, the man with the brains, David Addington. This was a decision that emanated from them and them alone, and was the decision-making involved no one else, not Colin Powell, not John Ashcroft. I think Ashcroft was probably angry. I believe the article mentioned this.
Oh, yeah.
This was coming out of his department without even his knowledge.
And he didn't know that his underling, John Yoo, had been meeting secretly with the vice president to draft this.
And this happened all the time. This happened with people from state. This happened with people from Treasury. This happened with people from the CIA, who, for lack of any better way of putting it, were actually working for the vice president primarily and secondarily working for their department or institution or agency.
This incident that's in the first section of the article in Sunday's Washington Post quotes Colin Powell saying, "What the hell just happened?" That's watching CNN on the evening of November the 13th, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And then equally blindsided was Condoleezza Rice.
Right. I think equally blindsided later would be the staff judge advocates of each of the armed forces and other people who should have had a dog in this fight, so to speak. Had a voice, at least, who never even were consulted. I would eliminate from that, I think, the OSD General Counsel, Haynes. I believe he knew about it all along and was complicit in it all along.
But Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, I think the real issue, surely, is that these decisions have proven to be some of the worst decisions in the history of United States foreign policy.
And that's the key, I think, to the angst in the American public and elsewhere in the Congress. I can point to, as a scholar, I can point to similar concentrations of power in previous presidencies, most markedly in Nixon's presidency, where Henry Kissinger actually became a co-president, to use Robert Dalek's term in his new book, Nixon and Kissinger. But most of the time, the decisions there, with the exception of Watergate, came out with positive results. The opening to China, SALT, the increased detente with the Soviet Union, all came out as successes and indeed ensured a landslide victory for President Nixon in his second term. With this set of decision makers, we've had disaster after disaster, domestic and international, and I think that's the reason we're going to see a lot of oversight now finally being exercised. We have to remember this Congress has only been in its seat for 5 months, But I think they're going to be working. I think Waxman, I think Levin at Senate Armed Services and others are going to be working hard on oversight. I think we're going to see some of these failures and the high-level responsibility for them exposed. What I'm concerned about is that there be accountability. I want to see some accountability at the highest levels.
And, of course, one of the reasons that, well, it's hard to understand why there has been no accountability, but I guess a part of the explanation is the excessive secrecy. And quoting the article here, Cheney declines to disclose the names or even the size of his staff, generally releases no public calendar, and ordered the Secret Service to destroy his visitors' logs. His general counsel has asserted that the vice president is a unique officer that is neither part of the executive branch nor part of the legislative branch and is therefore exempt from rules governing either. Cheney is refusing to observe an executive order on the handling of national security secrets, and he proposed to abolish the federal officer that insisted on auditing his compliance.
That's all true. And if you're concerned with communications, for example, from the statutory National Security Council, that is the one that was set up in the 1947 legislation, those communications are monitored by the vice president, and not true the other way around. So he has incredible power just in the way things have been organized, not just through his network in the departments and agencies, but also the way he is organized and can evade the statutory national decision-making process. Now, this is orchestrated in the beginning principally by his chief of staff at that time, Scooter Libby, and by, as I said, his brain trust in his office, David Addington. And one underestimates Addington at his peril because he's a brilliant man. Strange in some of his beliefs. I think one of his beliefs, for example, is that the United States Constitution is an anachronism and that what we really do need is a unitary executive. Read that in layman's terms as a monarchy, and with all the trappings thereof. And he's been behind a lot of these things, from detainee abuse to the determination that the vice president's office, preposterous determination, is not in the executive branch. And then I ask, where is it? And David, I expect, would say back, it's all by itself. Well, that sounds to me like tyranny.
Well, if indeed the vice president is above the law, as it appears his protectors say, I mean, how do we rein him in? I mean, I guess it's time for the Congress to assert its constitutional prerogatives.
Definitely. There was no oversight in the first Congress, the Republican Congress. There simply was no oversight. They went along with the White House. They stonewalled attempts by the Democrats to exercise oversight. They stonewalled attempts by their own people, such as Chuck Hagel, to exercise some sort of oversight. The first occasion of real, genuine oversight from the separate and equal branch of government, the Congress, has begun to occur now as the Democrats have gotten into their seats. And that is probably going to be the major means of accountability on this administration up to the new elections, when we'll throw the bastards out, as they say.
Well, again, the article mentions when Bob Graham, the chairman of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee, when he first goes to the White House, he's told that the vice president should be your point man at the White House. This is the president saying that Dick Cheney has the portfolio for intelligence activities. So not only is he excessively secret, he also is the keeper of the secrets. So why, therefore, is the president so detached? I mean, is he just sort of delegating to the point where one wonders what his role is?
I've wondered that for the last 2 or 3 years, certainly, and began wondering it even before that. This president, after all, is not, I voted for him, so mea culpa, but he's not steeped in foreign affairs, he's not steeped in domestic affairs. He was governor of a state that's a large state with a large population, has a lot of electoral votes, but anybody will tell you that the governor of Texas is more or less an impotent position. He's not a very powerful individual, one of the reasons why he had to work so closely with the legislature in Texas. We elected a man who was not presidential timber. I think that's one of the reasons people thought at first that Dick Cheney, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, and others being around him would be a good thing, because this was not a president who had a lot of experience at ruling, at managing, at leading a country of 300 million people with a $12 to $14 trillion GDP. And unfortunately, we have seen that in spades, exemplified by his having turned most of the essential decision-making over to the vice president. And when one says the president was consulted, one has to ask the question, by whom? Because most of the time, as my old boss, Ambassador Richard Haass, said, Dick Cheney got the last bite at the apple in the Oval Office by himself, with no one present but him and the president, or maybe Andy Card, the chief of staff at the time. So the vice president not only made decisions, he made sure the presidential decisions were his decisions.
Well, we know the consequences of this secret torture and detainment policy that has come back to haunt us and damaged irreparably, it seems, the United States has a good name abroad. We also know that shortly after the Iraq invasion, in about April, early April of 2003. Not long after that, the Iranians, who thought they'd be next, came hat in hand, ready to make a deal, and Cheney gave them the back of the hand. And now, of course, we find ourselves in such a mess in Iraq that Iran, who we've empowered, seems to have the upper hand. And then the stories that are coming out now about how Cheney's people and the neoconservatives in the Department of Defense were almost trying to gin up a war with China by encouraging the Taiwanese to declare independence, which to the Chinese on the mainland, where most of their military assets are right across the straits there, would consider causus belli. And here we have a situation where the neocons are pushing the Taiwanese into committing suicide, and apparently your boss Colin Powell had to send people over to undo the damage. And it turns out that Larry Derrida, Rumsfeld's aide, his wife is the sort of charge in Taiwan, which leads me. It's a long-winded way to get to the point, but this, again, shows that there's a kind of network of these people.
Absolutely. And one of the things that always saddened me and then bewildered me was when I would confront some of these people and ask them, for example, as I did one day with a particular undersecretary with regard to North Korea, okay, let's say we pursue your policy. And his policy at that time was no talking to the North Koreans, just regime change. Let's say we pursue that policy. What's the ultimate outcome of that policy? Well, I don't know. Well, I'll tell you what the ultimate outcome of that policy is. It's war on the Korean Peninsula. Our South Korean allies and us go to war with the North Koreans. That's the only way you're going to change the regime in Pyongyang the way you're talking about in the time frame you're talking about. The person looked back to me and said, I don't do war. That's not my business. I got that response from people all the time about the next step. If we pursue your policy, it is inevitably going to lead to a clash of arms. Well, we don't do that.
Well, just in closing, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, what is, I mean, clearly the loss of Rumsfeld and Libby have taken away some of the armor around the vice president. And one hears stories that when he leaves town, Bob Gates, the new Secretary of Defense, manages to get some face time with the president and manages to persuade him, particularly not to invade Iran and other things. So just give us a sense of where the country stands in terms of this unusual, opaque, dual leadership, where it's hard to know who's really running the store.
I think the vice president has been weakened. I can't put a qualifier on it and say markedly or remarkably or whatever, but I do think he's been weakened. I think he's been weakened by the departure of people, as you've indicated, Libby, Bolton, Joseph, Rumsfeld. And I also think he's been weakened, as you intimated also, by the fact that the president has been finally gotten to with regard to who was behind a lot of these decisions that led to such catastrophic failures. Iraq, Katrina, the situation in Afghanistan now is not very good either. So I do think his power has been diminished, but I don't underestimate him. He still has the capability to do things. Let me give you an example. The rumor was strong here in Washington, and I was getting it from some very solid sources, both in the government and out of the government, that a principals meeting was going to be held this past week, and they were going to decide to close Guantanamo. The president was going to make that decision. The word I got this morning is that principals meeting has been canceled, and the reason, because the vice president weighed in, and I assume that now he and the president are having a one-on-one about whether or not they proceed. That was going to be a very important decision to begin to restore America's reputation in the world, close down Guantanamo. And I understand now that the vice president has derailed that determination of the president to do so.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, we're very grateful for your unique experience and perspective, since you were an insider and been an eyewitness to the unraveling of our foreign policy. And I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Secretary of State Colin Powell's Chief of Staff in the Department of State from August 2002 to January of 2005, and he was the first to go public describing the Cheney-Rumsfeld cabal, and that, of course, has been expanded upon by the Washington Post starting Sunday with their series, Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency. And, of course, Angler is the Secret Service codename for the Vice President. I'm speaking with Robert Baer, the author of See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, How Washington Sold Our Soul for Saudi Crude, and more recently, Burned the House Down. He also writes regularly for Time.com. And this week in Iraq, which was your old stomping ground, it does appear that the offensive against al-Qaeda, and al-Qaeda seems to be everybody now, it seems, that they're the ubiquitous enemy now in Iraq. They slipped away. So what does it say about our intelligence?
The endless war. You got to keep in mind, these people don't wear uniforms. They're men and women. They're old men, old women. We can't tell who they are. It is virtually impossible to get inside these groups for precise targeting, simply because they're believers and they're willing to give up their lives. I've spent enough time with these people that you will not get anything out of them operationally that will help you target them or eliminate them. This is much worse than Vietnam.
But what about the idea that al-Qaeda has become the sort of ubiquitous label for everybody? And it's clearly there's all kinds of factions in Iraq.
It is ubiquitous. They're simplifying it for the American people, call him Qaeda, because Americans, if they don't follow the Middle East, tend to equate it with 9/11, people jumping out of the World Trade Center. That's Qaeda. In fact, these people are fighting a different war. In fact, we do not know what they're going to do next, whether they're going to come to this country, whether they're going to simply make Iraq into an Islamic Republic, or they're going to go into the Gulf and disrupt the oil. We have no idea who they are, just as we have no idea who the Shia are in Iraq and who they follow.
Well, what I think is pretty clear, though, isn't it, that they have a strategy and we don't? I mean, it seems to me that they know where all the soft spots are. They're moving into the Palestinian territories. They're moving into the Palestinian camps in Lebanon. They're using Iraq as a training ground. It seems that they have a strategy and we don't.
They do have a strategy, and, you know, frankly, they're smarter. They do not have wiring diagrams. They don't have PowerPoints. They get their direction off the Internet, out of the Quran. They know what they're doing. And it's a classic guerrilla warfare where they keep on moving, so we can't hit them. Our helicopters and Abrams tanks are doing no good at all. And it's not the military's fault either. We have put our military in an impossible situation, and we are destroying it incrementally.
So would the lesson therefore be that we shouldn't have fought them in the first place, or should have fought them differently? I mean, what's the lesson here?
The lesson is that we have to tell ourselves the truth. You know, Petraeus, the general in command in Iraq, keeps on saying, well, we're going to move the goalpost. It's no longer September. Maybe next year we'll start looking at this again. We have to tell ourselves it is an unwinnable war. End of story. We can't stop the jihadists coming in from Saudi Arabia and Syria and Iran. We don't know who the enemy is, as I've said. The lesson is, if you, let's just say you had to get rid of Saddam, which I totally think was one of the worst foreign policy mistakes we've ever made in our history. But if you did, we should have got in and out. The fact is that our soldiers are looked at as Christian crusaders, as Bush called them at one time. And as long as they're viewed that way, and they are almost universally in Iraq, except maybe the Kurds and a couple other minorities, they're going to be coming after us at all from all sides and all classes of society.
Well, you know, it's not entirely inaccurate to call them Christian. I don't know about the crusader part, but the fundamentalist Christians have invaded the U.S. military.
They have. I mean, you know, when we took Fallujah, took it back, they were playing Christian music. You know, this evangelical Christian strain has got into foreign policy and into the military. And at least that's the way it's read in the Middle East, which is the absolute worst possible thing, you know, propaganda we could have against us.
So here we are, essentially in despair about what's happening. And what do you think, Robert Baer, are the chances of this catastrophe getting worse with the notion that Vice President Cheney appears to be determined to do something about Iran?
Oh, we can't go into Iran. I would predict, and I'm very leery about predicting anything in the Middle East, that if we hit Iranian nuclear facilities, if we tried to destroy the regime in any way, we would see the effect in Iraq. Our supply lines would be cut. Basra is a city controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The hardline Iranians, they could cut our supply lines, which would mean, you know, World War III, essentially. They also could take out, probably within a couple days, half of the Gulf's oil supplies simply by firing rockets at the major facilities, which would be Opcak in Saudi Arabia, the North Field in Qatar, and on and on and on. And this is why the military and people responsible in Washington, and I'm talking about the CIA and State Department, are so opposed to Cheney and what he's doing against Iran.
But it seems it's already having consequences, because if we're discussing this, you better believe the Iranian government feels like an attack is very likely, if not imminent, and they seem to be cracking down at home and creating, and we've actually helped the Iranian government become more reactionary and turn against their own people, and what little democratic space that was there is being closed.
Absolutely. It's the worst possible thing for us to have troops on the east and the west of that country, and Azerbaijan on the north is not particularly helpful either. So they're completely surrounded, and at the risk of being politically incorrect, the Iranians are paranoid, and you're going to see them push back. And what really concerns the State Department, the CIA, is some crazy commander in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps firing at one of our carriers and corking off a war we can't win, nor can they.
Well, at the moment, you know, you see these pictures in the New York Times on Sunday of the students being harassed by the Basiji, the religious police, and I mean, it looks as though we're helping turn the clock back, if you will.
Oh, we are. I think that I'm fairly convinced that the five contractors, British contractors, were taken about a month ago, were taken by the Iranians. This is what they do when they feel threatened. They take hostages and they turn to terrorism. They haven't so far turned to terrorism, but they could at any moment. It could occur in Lebanon. It could occur in Israel. The group in control of Gaza right now, Hamas, has very close ties with Tehran, the leadership.
And how do you explain that across the religious divide, given that the Hamas was originally influenced by the Muslim Brotherhood out of Egypt?
Well, in fact, we can pinpoint the date. It was 1991 that the Iranians made inroads into Hamas and started providing weapons and explosives to the leadership in Lebanon. In 1994, at Marj al-Zahour, when Hamas was thrown out, it was the Iranians who met them in Lebanon and gave them blankets and food and the rest of it. So this has been a gradual thing, and Hamas looks at the Iranians not particularly as, you know, soulmates, and they're certainly from a different sect, but as their best protectors right now.
So what does that say about the Israelis? I mean, here they are, the great military superpower, the world's fourth largest arms manufacturer, the world's fifth largest nuclear power, and yet they're allowing the Iranians in their back door.
It was a mistake. It was a horrible mistake. Invading Lebanon in 1982 and not immediately leaving was a huge mistake because it simply invited the Iranians to come in, train Hezbollah, train the Palestinians, hijack radical Palestinians, and now they're back at their door again. And they should have just, like, as we should have got out of Iraq immediately. That's what they should have done in Lebanon. So the Israelis are partly responsible for this as well.
And I remember talking to you about a year ago when you'd just been to Gaza and the West Bank, and you predicted a civil war.
Oh, you could see it. You can feel it. You can feel that whole parts of Gaza are completely radicalized. The Israelis at the time were telling me they were affiliated with Osama bin Laden, and I believe them. And he's looked at a symbol. You don't need direct contact with him. You don't need to be in the chain of command, but you just look at who he is, and he's the symbol of more than Islam, but anti-colonialism.
Well, but it seems that what he thrives on is a failed state, and that's what appears to be unraveling in Lebanon and in Palestine. So,
and it's going to spread to Syria.
And of course, we've already handed him Iraq in that sense.
Yeah, we've handed him the entire Levant. And you look at the map, and that's the roof that sits on 2/3 of the world's oil supplies or reserves.
So obviously, historians will look upon President George W. Bush as being guilty of the reckless endangerment of the United States and the West, if you will. But is there any way to salvage anything, or is this just inexorable that our mistakes are our gift to bin Laden?
It was a complete gift to bin Laden. And you really have to wonder if he shouldn't be impeached before it gets worse, because we need in the next 2 years to do something about Iraq. Simply postponing it until you get another administration is going to make things infinitely worse.
But is there anything we can do about Iraq?
There's nothing you can do. The only thing you can do is pull out and hope the whole movement burns itself out. But the problem is that American troops, Christian troops, are a catalyst for violence. It sounds very theoretical, and it sounds nice, because if the chaos spreads to the Gulf, we're in big trouble. But we can't stay either. This war is just a complete catastrophe. But I mean, and it's not that people didn't see it before.
Mm-hmm.
The State Department saw it. We know the CIA saw the catastrophe, potential catastrophe, and so did anybody who knew the Arabs.
So this was just the hubris of I take it that in many ways it's been Cheney's war, and Cheney and Rumsfeld have been. We were talking earlier with Colonel Wilkerson that they've been running. This is their foreign policy.
It's a foreign policy goes back to Reagan administration. I was in Damascus when Rumsfeld showed up, and he was insistent that the Syrians stop the Islamic insurgency in Lebanon. The ambassador at the time was so incensed that he got up and left Damascus on vacation because he couldn't stand the sight of Rumsfeld. The funny thing is, when he left the residency, and Rumsfeld had the right to stay in the residency as an ambassador, he locked up the liquor cabinet and the refrigerator. Not that it did much. But the point was that Rumsfeld really thought that he could go to the Syrians and control what was happening in Lebanon. And here we see it 23 years later, 20 years later, and Rumsfeld hasn't learned anything about Islam, about what's going on in the Middle East, about anti-colonialism and the rest of it. We have to get across that barrier and describe facts as they are, and that's the only way we can do it, and we can't do it with Cheney and Bush in the White House and with a pliant Congress.
Well, just in closing, Bob, obviously, I mean, it's clear to me this had a lot to do with oil, surely. I mean, didn't they see this as an oil grab?
They saw it as an oil grab. They saw it as some sort of fantasy that the Middle East was like Eastern Europe. If we just would go in and pull the equivalent of the Berlin Wall down, democracy would flower.
Hmm.
But remember, these people have never set foot in the Middle East other than flying into Riyadh or something for a day and then leaving. They've never been to a Palestinian camp. They've never talked to Hezbollah. And, you know, as much as, you know, it would serve that part of the region well, democracy, it just doesn't work now. And that's the facts they can't deal with.
Well, just in closing, I wanted to touch on the release of the CIA so-called crown jewels, which were originally Colby had, through the Church Committee, a lot of information had been released, and Henry Kissinger persuaded General Ford to hold back these documents. They've now come out. You've had a chance to look at some of them. What's your reaction?
My take is the CIA is pushing back, which is good. They're saying, look, the CIA was politicized all these years. It was doing things it was not meant to do, you know, assassinate Castro, Trujillo, and the rest of it. And I think it's actually a good thing, bring this stuff out. And, you know, and what I'd like them to do is bring out information on the secret prisons and torture. Because remember that the 9/11 Commission report is based on the testimony of people who were tortured. And until we get to the bottom of that, people are going to believe the worst conspiracies about 9/11, and that's not healthy for this country.
So how do you explain then that Hayden's letting out these secrets from the past, and yet we've got Dick Cheney acting almost insane, holding on to secrets, pretending he's a part of the legislative branch, et cetera, et cetera?
I think it's great. We've got the military dealing with facts and Cheney refusing to deal with facts. Just like in the McCarthy area, when we have the military telling the truth, we solve a lot of problems.
Well, I'm glad we're ending on a somewhat positive note. How unusual. I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Bob Baer.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. I'm speaking with Glenn Greenwald, who's an author, journalist, and blogger who was previously a constitutional law and civil rights litigator in New York. His writing appears regularly at Salon.com. He's the author of the New York Times bestselling book, How Would a Patriot Act? A Critique of the Bush Administration's Use of Executive Power, which was came out in 2006. And his new book, Tragic Legacy, examines the Bush legacy and will be released in bookstores coming Tuesday, which is June the 26th, in a couple of days' time. Glenn, thank you for joining us from sunny Brazil.
It is sunny, and my pleasure to be here.
And just a little while ago, we had Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on, who was the chief of staff of Colin Powell in the first Bush term. And in the Sundays, today's Washington Post, there is a new series of articles beginning Angler, the Cheney vice presidency. It will continue through Wednesday of this week, detailing the unprecedented power and influence of the vice president over all matters of policy throughout the entire branch. But Colonel Wilkerson, of course, was pointed out this insane idea that David Addington came up with, the unitary executive. And I mean, it is extraordinary that they're claiming that because there's a war on terror, they're therefore wartime presidents or co-presidents or whatever they are. And that they're really the commander-in-chief, not the president. So even though 90% of us are civilians, apparently we've all been drafted into this army and lost our Bill of Rights. And even when this feckless Congress passes something, Bush Cheney then turns around with a signing statement saying they don't obey. When is this other branch of government ever going to step up to the plate and fulfill its constitutional requirements?
I wrote my first book out of a sense of frustration over the fact that there is an extraordinary political development in our country that is receiving very little attention, and it still is. I wrote my book on these radical executive power theories last year in April and May of 2006, the book was released. And the reason I wrote it was because we really do have a government, a president and the vice president, who have explicitly asserted the theory that they are empowered to act without any constraints of any kind from any of the other branches, including restraints imposed by law. when it comes to all matters regarding national security. And you're exactly right that the powers that they, that normally the top general would have in terms of how he treats foreign combatants on a battlefield is a, are powers that they believe that they have on every square inch of the planet, because every square inch of the planet, in their view, is a battlefield in the war on terror. And that includes U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. And they have, in fact, detained without any charges U.S. citizens on U.S. soil and believe that they have the power to do that. So, you know, I think that it's true that these theories emanate from Dick Cheney, but they very much play into the belief by of George Bush that we face this epic war of good and evil and of civilization, and that nothing should or can constrain his power in fighting that, that battle.
But he wasn't elected to be a king. He was a, this country has a constitution, and I just am astounded. I mean, we know that so much of the judiciary has been taken over, if you will, by the Federalist types, and these latest two Supreme Court justices, the Associate Justice and the Chief Justice, are both presidential lawyers with an obvious bias. And he may have another bite of the apple too before he's done, right? With a
One of the extraordinary political facts, of course, is that the very few checks and limitations that have been imposed on the president over the last 5 years have really come recently, within the last year or two, in the form of the Supreme Court imposing very modest limits on what the president can do, striking down the Guantanamo process in Hamdan last year, and before that, imposing some mild limits on how the president can imprison U.S. citizens in the Hamdi case in 2003. Both of those decisions were 5-4 decisions, and one of the five is now 87 years old, John Paul Stevens. And, you know, he's obviously not going to remain on the court forever, and even those few limits that have been imposed are very much endangered. And I think that's really the point is, you know, the founders built our government based on the expectation that we would have political leaders at some point who tried to acquire tyrannical power or who sought to rule outside of the rule of law. That's not surprising. And what they did was they constructed numerous safeguards to prevent that from happening, and those safeguards in the last 6 years have largely failed. The courts have been way too deferential. Congress has been completely non-existent in terms of standing up to the president, even after the 2006 election. And most of all, the press, which is supposed to be the true watchdog over government deceit and corruption, has become completely appropriated by the government. And not only do they stand idly by while this happens, they actively participate in helping to conceal it. And that's been the true political crisis in our country.
But the exercise of this unprecedented power seems to be, though, largely at the behest of the powerful interests that these men represent. I mean, you could make the case that the Iraq War is a not in the national interest, but in the corporate interest, and the national interest is actually suffering, but the corporate interest, particularly the Halliburtons of this world, and the Exxons are making out fine. And if you just have to look at what just happened in the Senate with this energy bill, that is a complete disgrace, where the Republicans managed to get remove the requirement that 15% of all electricity generated in this country come from renewable sources. And then another aspect of the bill that the Republicans got rid of was a $30 billion tax on the windfall profits that oil companies are having in order to stimulate alternatives. And here's a president who says we're addicted to oil, and now he's threatening to veto this very weak and eviscerated energy bill.
Well, there's no question that, you know, the Beltway, the entire, all appendages of our political process are driven by large corporate interests. I mean, I don't think you can find very many people who would dispute that. And, you know, one of the central points that I make in my current book, A Tragic Legacy, is that, essentially what has happened is, you know, when Bush was reelected in 2004, and when he was when he became president in 2000, each time he had a very, very you know, small portion of the population supporting him, 50% roughly of the voting electorate, and that's been composed of, you know, several different political factions. One is very large corporate interest and oil interest, and another are people who believe in a very rigid Christian theology. And then another are these sort of neoconservative warmongers who are focused on Israel and the Middle East. And these factions have really kind of banded together and have had their interests converge, especially in the Middle East, in terms of wars and here at home domestically, in terms of expanding government power. Those two go hand in hand. And they've kind of wrapped it up in this moralistic package of the need to fight against terrorist evil and defend the good or the American way of life. And so what really is going on, the true interests that are served by these policies have been largely obscured by this moralistic narrative that they've packaged it all in and that the media has really mindlessly transmitted.
But Glenn Greenwald, everything that you've said that they've done is obviously clear, but the bottom line is that it's all backfired, that they've actually ended up being the gift that keeps on giving vis-a-vis bin Laden, and he's getting stronger and stronger every day, and we're getting weaker and weaker. So, this guy ought to be tried for the reckless endangerment of both the United States and the planet.
Well, it's one of the real paradoxes. You know, typically there's a balance, a trade-off between freedom and security. And, you know, the founders warned against being willing to give up too much freedom in exchange for security. And what we've done is given up freedom and in exchange for becoming much less secure. This agenda has been justified in the name of increased security, and yet you're absolutely right. You know, there's documents that have been recovered from raids that we've done that the CIA has, and even bin Laden's public speeches, in which what al-Qaeda wanted more than anything was to provoke the U.S. into invasions of Middle East countries, because that enables al-Qaeda to depict the U.S. as imperialistic and in a war against Islam, and helps their recruiting. And this imperialistic path that we're pursuing, this attempt to dominate the Middle East, is one that we simply don't have the resources to sustain. It's not even something that we can do. And the more we try, as you suggest, the weaker we become, and the more emboldened and the stronger Islamic extremists and terrorists become. And so the agenda has achieved the exact opposite of what they claimed it was intended to achieve.
So let me get this straight. We have an administration that has grabbed power in an unprecedented way, mimicking the kind of impulses of monarchs, going back to George III, who the American Revolution was organized against. So they've grabbed unprecedented power, and they've used this power to make a complete mess of things. And it'd be one thing if you lied your way into a war, and the war was successful, and you managed to steal a bunch of oil and keep us hooked on cheap oil. But they've blown it. They've made a complete mess of things, and now it's getting exponentially worse. So who's watching the store here? What's wrong with the American people? Why haven't they figured out that these guys are the wrecking crew?
Well, I think that's a bit unfair in the sense that the American people have figured it out. And if you look at polling data with regard to their views about the war, not only is, you know, the huge bulk of the American population against this war, believe that it was a mistake, believe that the government deliberately deceived the American people to support the war, and believe that we ought to withdraw. Not only do they believe all of that, but they also have abandoned this president and believe that his presidency is a failure to a magnitude that really is unparalleled in modern politics. I mean, this goes back to even 2004, when he was barely reelected, even though he was a war president, which is no war president has ever lost reelection in American history. He almost did. despite having a very politically ungifted opponent. So, you know, I think the American people have actually been ahead of our political press and pundits
So what
in
is
terms
it, is,
of realizing what a disaster this war has become.
So he's polling at 26. I mean, Nixon went down to 23 at the worst of Watergate. But the American people are then they're just frustrated because there's nobody to turn to. Is that what's going on?
Well, you know, I think that the American people perceive what a disaster this presidency has been, how they feel deceived into having supported it on false pretenses. And I also think they're frustrated that there's been no real alternative presented. The Democrats have been really just unbelievably anemic when they've attempted to stand up to the president at all. But I think the danger is that unless Bush is going to be gone in January of 2009, no matter what, but the political movement that has propped him up and created him and supported him and all those interests that you referred to earlier, they're not going anywhere. And they're looking for a replacement who will appear to be different cosmetically, but who in fact will be committed to the same mindset. And so until that worldview is really critiqued and criticized and uprooted and exposed, you know, my concern is that while Bush himself is unpopular, there's the opportunity that they have to deceive Americans into supporting someone who looks different, but who in fact will be more of the same.
And of course, your book, Tragic Legacy, I suppose it sort of says it all, but, you know, just in closing, have you figured out what motivates this president? Because he must be aware of his unpopularity. Maybe he doesn't care. I don't know.
Well, I think there's been some debates, you know, even since I started talking about my book, about the extent to which, for example, Bush really is a true believer in terms of his evangelical convictions. And, you know, I think it's fairly clear that he does believe, at least to some degree, these messianic impulses, that, you know, he's carrying out God's will by battling against pure evil and defending this God's will, that freedom be battled for. And I think, you know, the interests around him, Cheney and neocons and others, are able to persuade him by packaging those agendas in a way that appeals to that evangelical sense that he has. But I think beyond that, too, is there's a belief that he has that he's just immune from error and is free from doubt. And once he makes a decision, he will never reverse it or abandon it, no matter how obvious it becomes that it's misguided and wrong, because his first priority is to, in essence, be vindicated as being right and to never give his enemies, domestic and foreign, any quarter. And so I think it's really kind of a pathological refusal to ever be able to recognize error and to continue that agenda no matter what.
Well, if he's polling at 26%, that means that 73% of the people in this country are his enemies. I mean, perhaps that's overstating
it. But I don't think he cares. I mean, I think, you know, and he said so. He said that even if, you know, only Laura and his
24%.
Dog are the last supporters, he'll continue because he knows that he is right and that history will vindicate him. And that's a very dangerous attitude to have. And there's 18 months left in his presidency and a lot of damage that can be done in that time.
Well, thank you for joining us, Glenn Greenwald, and for your book, Tragic Legacy. And again, much appreciate you joining us here from Brazil.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Master. Just speaking then with Glenn Greenwald, author, journalist, and blogger. He writes for Salon.com. His previous book was How Would a Patriot Act? And his new book, Tragic Legacy, is about to be published this coming Tuesday. I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer. This program is available at ianmasters.org, where all programs are archived.